now.
It's on my trust. Oh, Mr. Moses, how did you get into the civil rights movement? Or the, old story.
The free press of the civil rights movement. I had left school, Oberlin College I went to.
Yes.
I left school because I wanted to be either an actor or a writer. I wanted to be both. And I involved myself in some off-Broadway plays.
Hold a second, I'll check this out. When was this?
This was last year at this time. I left Oberlin, went to New York to act and to write. I had been involved in civil rights activities in a college at Oberlin. I had come and visited to the college during the time I was at college. That was 2 years ago. And I decided to write when I went to New York. And I kept in touch with Charles Butts, whom I had known at Oberlin, and kept in touch with the people working for the Free Press. And over the summer, I became much more involved in the picketing.
Where was this?
In New York, the White Castle picketing in the Bronx. I became much more actively involved in demonstrations and civil rights protests.
Now, how did that happen? How did you become more actively involved? What motive? What made you do that?
It starts from, I don't know if I can talk about the motive. My interest in exactly what was taking place and the manner in which I might help it. And I believe I'm working on some sort of philosophy. Something has to do with the individual being of utmost importance.
Couldn't you pull over and hear so you can have a shot? I'll move it to you when you speak.
Of utmost importance to the individual, and the fact that the individual himself could make a great deal of difference in any system. An outside or a new element would make a great deal of difference in the system. And at this time, I was questioning my restraint, the fact that I hadn't actively participated in demonstrations. I'd only sort of accumulated a great deal of knowledge and interest. And also the questioning of not only why me, but why not me? This catapulted me sort of in the demonstrations in New York. At this time, I was working as a copy boy for the New York Post. I constantly, every day, I read news articles about civil rights activities in the South, or riots in Algeria, or whatever. And I then decided that I wanted to come south to work. But there were other things involved which I know specifically. Since I was very small, I was involved in a theater in Cleveland called Caramel. And for quite a while, I've thought about starting a theater in the South somewhere. And along with my sudden awareness of civil rights activity was the thought of coming to Jackson and casing the joint, so to speak, looking around for the best place to start a Southern theater or a theater. I ultimately wanted to be to combine acting and writing as a playwright. So what I'm doing, so coming down to work for the Free Press at the same time cased the situation to see whether it was possible, whether I was prepared to start a theater here. And that's exactly what I'm doing.
You are starting a theater here?
I had intended on bringing you a prospectus of the theater, which I had.
Will you send me one?
I will send you one, yes. It now has the sponsorship of Harry Belafonte, James Baldwin, a repertory theater, hopefully, with the base in Jackson. Money given through Tougaloo. We hope to be taken under Tougaloo College as their summer theater project and to have to start with the Summer Stock Theater this summer.
Do they have a theater already there?
They have a theater there, yes.
How would U.S. differ from their present theater?
Their theater is mainly for a college audience. They're doing things that were just perspectives of a college audience, and I want to have a collective religious phenomenon here in the South. I want to play to the Negro audience in general, the communities here, the farm workers and the cotton pickers and those people.
What plays do you envisage as the plays you would produce?
The only plays that I see that I can, that are possible, plays that I want. I've gone through the whole thing of the Negro plays. I've only known one play that I think would be proper to produce here, and this only comes close to the type of play that I want to see done, and that's Pearly Victorious. As far as a Negro play, I was thinking of doing Antigone or an adaptation of. But the other plays would have to be, and I have been, and written by myself and by other people whom I have interest in.
But you intend to produce classics?
I intend to produce
as
classics.
As well.
Yes. But mostly concentrating on works of Negro playwrights and works of people involved with me here.
Would you see those plays as necessarily, in quotes, plays directed at propaganda or action and action, or would you see it simply as plays which might be of interest to this particular audience?
It would naturally be both. There are a few set things that I can say. A play must be entertaining. Propaganda in favor of thinking. That's the phrase I can use.
That's any good play, then.
Any good play, yes. It would be any good play, except that I have certain ideas as how the propaganda should be directed and written. I am also concerned. I can also state that any good play would be educational and propagandistic at the same time.
But as Hedda Gabler would be, for instance.
Hedda Gabler would be my but not only not for this audience because of the levels of history.
That's something, yes. I mean, in theory, it would be as relevant as another.
Yes, I could do Eschylus to Albi. Yes.
When do you expect to be in business with this theater? Next summer?
Beginning of this summer.
This coming summer?
Yes. I hope to have the theater facilities at Tupelo. We're asking for donations. And I'm working with a group now, students from Jackson State and students from Tupelo who are interested in the theater. And I'm giving them lessons, so to speak. We're forming a troupe. And I've learned different repertory techniques that are cheap, that we can use for traveling. I want to play in the communities here, the rural communities in Chester.
Do you have a program for the summer already laid down? Have you chosen your plays?
Pearly Victorious.
Yeah.
Lost in the Stars, quite ambitious, I know. It's two of these are considerations, and a play which I'm putting together.
Your play?
Yes. Which will be a sort of documentary of Jackson in 1963.
Let me read a quotation to you. This is getting off the point to you both. From Dr. Kenneth Clark, you know who he is, the psychologist at CCNY. Reference to Martin Luther King's philosophy. I can use this as a starting point. On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability. While the black nationalists betray pathology and instability. A deep analysis, however, reveals that there is also an unrealistic, if not pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment, the forms which such bitterness takes need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the human spirit seems inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victims of oppression be required to love those who oppress them places an additional and intolerable psychological burden upon these victims. How would you respond to that? How would you respond to just that? Murphy, isn't it?
Yes, Murphy.
Mr. Murphy.
A lot of one time.
Well, you start, then. Why don't you?
Well, my reaction, I don't know how I can exactly react. Whether I'm so to say I think that's true or false, except that I think that any invocation, a religious invocation, I think it's just as harmful as a racist invocation, unless they're both used as a tactic and not as a philosophy. I think that even Negro itself, we must understand that I've often thought that we're sympathetic, actually, to white supremacists. Because we've been forced to think along those terms of Negro or racism. But we must understand that we can't use that as a philosophy, but as a tactic in order for organization, in order to get what the, well...
You mean use the concept of Negro as a tactic to get solidarity for practical purposes, is that it?
Yes. And I think that in the first sense, nonviolence and religious nonviolence, and the racism that the Muslims are in the first, that tactics. But when they become religious beliefs or philosophy, I think that they're limiting and harmful to reflective thinking.
That is, you are the anti-theological.
I'm definitely. I'm not saying that I'm anti-theological. I'm saying that I'm anti, in the way religion has been practiced here, I think religion is a great stumbling block to a great many of the Negroes.
Well, now, what do you distinguish between the truths of Christianity, truths in whatever quote you want to put them in, or principles, in whatever light you want to see them as revealed or as man-made, distinguishing that side from the matter of practice? Now, I'm certain that Martin Luther King would make that distinction and say that he is not defending the practice of Christianity as it's been observed in Birmingham.
Yeah, all right. What I'm saying is that everyone, I suppose, we all make this distinction between the creed and the American creed, let's say, and how it is practiced. I'm saying that any time this is used, or any time there are words one can extract other than the real thing, the reality of what nonviolence is, the reality of what racism is, I think anything, something otherworldly or supernatural, religious, and both of them become religious, it seems, when that is extracted, it is harmful. So when I make the distinction, naturally I can make the distinction between practices and whatever it is. I think organized religion, unless it serves a definite sociological function, and naturally the sociological function has to be one which I think would be constructive to producing an atmosphere of reflective thinking or thought, I think any other type of organization is harmful. And I think the religions that are organized, even nonviolence, when it's organized on that type of basis, is harmful. And Black Muslimism also. I also think I am much more in sympathy with the Black Muslim creed than I am with the King's philosophy of nonviolence.
This reminds me of something that I first encountered many years ago in reading Du Bois. He talked about the split in the Negro psyche between an attachment to a Negro tradition, toward the Negro blood, toward the solidarity of experience, the community of experience, the identification of the Negro self with the Negro-ness, and exclusive of the white cultural tradition and the white mode of life and everything else, this distinction. On the other hand, the pull, the contradictory pull, on the other, it splits the Negro psyche, according to his interpretation, the pull toward the Western cultural tradition, the pull to identify with that, to integrate with that, to be absorbed, perhaps, in the end, into that, and to lose, perhaps in the course of time, the very identity of Negro, in a common bloodstream, in a common cultural situation. This, for him, is a division, a split difficult to heal. Now, it remains that for some people. What would you say to this as a problem? Is it a problem for you?
Yes, it has been a problem. The Africans term this Negroness something like negritude.
Negritude or mystique noire.
Mystique noire. You see, we can talk about it in two zones. For me, and I'm repeating things that I've thought about before, for me, the world or my outlook, my view, certainly always contain, have something to do with race. I will see a multiplicity of colors. I will see a multiplicity of bone structures. I can think of it in these terms that I will never forget who I am, let's say a Negro or where I've come from. I think this is the fact that we do have a unity of, at least, I don't know if we have a unity of outlook or view. At least those Negroes, say, who've reached some sort of equanimity have a unity of outlook, which can be termed this mystique noir or the negritude, the fact that they are Negroes and they have a certain unique experience as Negro that a white person is unable to share. As far as it actually existing, I think it's more of an intangible thing made tangible. And I think it's an imposition. It's an imposed tangibility. This uniqueness is one that's imposed simply. In the same sense, I think a great deal of our other things that we actually pride ourselves in. We, even though we reject the stereotype, the rhythm, the whole talented bit in the sports, there's a certain pride and attachment to this negritude, which in fact encompasses the stereotype that we fought against.
Would you? That's a very interesting point. That it encompasses the stereotype you have fought against. Well, what I'm asking now, may I state it another way? To reverse the question, would you, along this line of thought, envisage or conceive of a time when, say, civil rights are achieved, opportunities have been evened out, that the pressures are removed, then would negritude disappear? Or is that simply brought on by external pressure? Or do you feel it's a positive which you would cling to pridefully under all circumstances?
At this point, I would say that it was positive, and that I would cling to. and that I think the only time that one can reach some sort of, and this is the contradiction, some sort of equanimity, is by accepting the negritude. Now, this goes back into what I think about theater. I think that a great deal of many of us have not turned back to the other people, the other Negro people who are struggling through the same, not only economic evolutions, but mental evolutions of thought. And I think that it's that only through our own culture, only through our own unique experience, will we ever be able to think in terms, or will we ever be able to think in terms of some, we ever be able to gain some sort of universality. Let's say we'll only be able to lose our negritude by turning directly into it and accepting it and creating from it. I don't know exactly, T.S. Eliot talks about the way of dispossession, or the way of possession is to go by dispossession. And I kind of believe this. The only way that I feel that I can be a writer is to devote my time to writing, which limits my world severely. And I don't want to say the only time I could be a Negro, but the only way that I am going to be able to use my unique experience as a Negro, if I'm going to use this to create from it, which I must do in order to be an artist, I have to think of turning back to the people whence I came and the times from whence I came to help them and seek solutions on a level that would involve Negroes themselves. And through this way, perhaps we can approach a culture. We can actually approach the thing, I'm sorry, in history we've always heard of everyone quickly states the new Negro. Everyone quickly says there's a Negro culture, but I'm assured that this Negro wealth, this Negro culture hasn't been developed, and it's because Negroes haven't turned back to work within it and to develop it. I don't think, I think that we will have a negritude, an honest, positive negritude, only when Negroes go back, become Negroes, and work within their own culture to produce their culture.
Does that mean that you refer to Africa, or just to the development of, say, the American Negro community, that community of experience here, as opposed to the African experience?
I think that the Africans are here. That they don't. I'm referring to the American Negro experience.
Without reference to the African experience.
Because I think the Africans are starting from that. They've had much more unanimity of thought and unanimity of culture than the American Negro. At least their ambition and their determination hasn't been drained from them by this system.
You mean that the American Negro, to state it, I'm trying to interpret it to myself, was deculturized when brought to America.
I
had to
start
over again in terms of the Western context, the Western cultural context. Is that it?
So. Yes.
May I ask a question, a little bit of an aside, but does it strike you as possible that the Southerner, the man down here in the street in Jackson, Mississippi, in his blind, blundering way, not a thoughtful man, say, is partly, among other motives, trying to defend a sense of cultural identity against the pressures of an outside world that is fixed on his relation to the Negro as a necessary aspect of his cultural identity? See what I'm driving at?
You talk. It's a baited question.
It's a what?
It's a baited question.
It's baited, yes. But that doesn't mean you that I'm trying to dictate an answer.
Certainly.
Any good question is baited.
Talk to the man. But
that is, put it over. Is there a Southern tradition like negritude which could be conceived of positively as distinguishable from a view which says we must embrace the whole theory of racism and the oppression of the Negro to defend the cultural identity? Another approach to it, you see. Or this way, right or wrong, is a southerner with more or less self-awareness trying to defend his cultural identity against Americanism as another culture, modern industrial finance capitalism. Does that make any sense?
I would think that the conservative southerner tends to be more fundamentally American than perhaps Americans in any other region.
In what sense? That's interesting.
In terms of fundamentalism in religion, I don't know. I think all of this has to be realized in terms of enormous contradictions. Fundamentalism in religion, which can never quite explain the parts of its own creed that are missing. The enormous amount of attention that is paid to terms like laissez-faire and free enterprise, which is being stifled by outside pressures, which seems to me a much more fundamental and much earlier idea of Americanism than one's likely to find in the North. The point is that none of these terms, that neither the religious nor the political terms, ever complete themselves. It seems to me as though they're almost used as blankets to conceal any further thought.
At the same time, that a man says laissez-faire and states' rights, this, he wants a big handout from the federal government. Is that it?
No, not that simple. But at the same time that you maintain that every man has a right to succeed by his own initiative, that you also maintain a system of racial suppression.
Yes.
In which case the term becomes so large, or all the terms of Southern in the Southern Southern thought, it seems to me, become so large that they rule out all other areas of thought.
To take another thing about the Southern situation, James Baldwin writes this in his last book. The Southern mob does not represent the majority will of the South. See, it merely moves in to fill a moral vacuum. That's almost a direct quote. Does that make any sense to you?
Doc. You were doing much better than I.
In fact, many people say the same thing. That even the police don't represent the majority will. Beg pardon?
I think that's true. To talk about whether the mob moves in to fill a moral vacuum or not, that's explicit. That prevents me thinking any further than that. I think that's beautiful. As far as the police not representing the majority of what we find here is a legalized and enforced segregation, enforced discrimination. We find that the institutions have built within every facet of themselves discriminatory practices. And that continue to exist when the opinions of the people who work with those institutions change. Their practices still exist. I think mostly that the system, I think people left alone if it wanted. If the city officials and the government officials themselves did not enforce, they did not keep this thing in the papers and social. We have people who control institutions here, are definitely segregation, who mold the opinions of the people here. And if not for these people, I think I think it would take much more natural course. But we have the headermans as far as the newspaper is concerned, and we have the police officials themselves who actually enforce. They control themselves. When we go to a bus station here, they tell you to move to the other. The people themselves don't, even though they think they are following the majority will of the people. And, they tell you, the people in the institutions themselves tell you to sit over here, et cetera. The bus drivers or whatever are the people who, of course, depends on whether the masses, if they ever had such a position as policemen or bus driver, et cetera, would do this too. You understand that I think it's a legalized, I think it's an enforced thing by city officials and not the majority of the people. To talk about the moral vacuum is
I see the moral vacuum specials around here.
Yeah, you're
talking about Mr. Murphy.
I'm sorry.
Let's drop that. Excuse me, please. Go ahead if you want to speak.
No. Go on.
It's said over and over again. This is from Sterling Brown, you know. This is a quotation from Sterling Brown.
I don't know Sterling Brown.
It's a Negro writer and professor.
Where?
He was at Howard, I think. I mean, I've read him for years. He's not a young man. The Negro's plight in the South will be lightened only when the plight of the poor white is lightened. When these cannot be pitted against each other in hatred and contempt, that their fates are tied together. Ultimately.
Gunnar Myrdal made an interesting statement in which I read by a storm. He said the Negro revolution or rebellion was the first step in ending the apathy of the U.S. poor in general. In other words, that was creating an awareness about whatever the situations, the poverty and if we agree that a country or a state, the prosperity of a country depends on the resources of that country and then of that state, except if we cut out help from the federal government, then we have to recognize that Mississippi is the lowest, is economically poor, one of the lowest states in the Union. Certainly, if we could approach this normally, approach the problems normally, say by bringing in programs and doing things that would be best economically for Mississippi, instead of using the racial as a lever to continue the oligarchy, the ruling rich few here, then we could start as any other normal country, let's say, or any other normal state starts, and recognize and face the fact that we're very low economically and there's certain programs that are needed to, by training all the resources, there's certain programs that are needed to better, to have progress in Mississippi. And with the acceptance of this fact, then, I'm just sort of paraphrasing exactly what he's saying.
Yes.
The Negro and the white poor farmer, the poor person, would certainly be in the same boat, because Mississippi is definitely poor. After we demonstrate, where can we go? Mississippi doesn't have enough money to furnish jobs. We can't expect an economic turnover immediately. We can't expect an educational turnover immediately. In other words, Mississippi has a long way to go before it reaches any sort of level of prosperity. Only thing we can say is that it's hindered because the ruling few use a great deal of propaganda, granted, in order and the race lever, et cetera, et cetera. So I certainly think that statement is true.
You would say that that the oligarchy in Mississippi uses the race question as a device to maintain its own position. Is that it?
Yes.
Its own economic advantage.
Yes.
How conscious do you think that is? Or is that simply a sociological reflex on their part, an inborn wisdom, an inborn cunning?
I don't know if it's any longer conscious. I don't. I certainly know that it's conscious in the sense that, you see, I've talked to a few southerners here who actually are not able to reason. They pride themselves in being reasonable, but are not able to distinguish real issues. As far as I can see, the real issues are. All I know is that the system is a beautiful system. It's an almost perfect system that has to be measured in terms of accumulation of past and history rather than something that is a conscious effort to maintain every day. That it started long ago in Mississippi legislature has been passing laws that have reinforced it, and the educational institution has reinforced the system and the way of thinking here, so that I often think that rather than being conscious, it's the system itself and all the ramifications and the vicious cycles of the system are not necessarily conscious, but inescapable. And the only way that these things can be broken up is by massive outside elements coming in to the system.
Do you notice any difference between, say, the young, those under 30, and those above 30?
I don't know if I can make such a distinct division.
Well, I put the knife edge down arbitrarily there.
Yeah.
Between, say, the young and the middle-aged, whatever that line is.
You see, I think you want to say something.
Let me see. Yeah, I would. Okay.
Please.
I would think generally that the propaganda machine for racist propaganda has become more and more well-oiled, and is more closely organized around a few cliches which seem to control thought. I would think, unless the young people here have had a chance for some exposure, either in their homes, some independence at home, or some exposure out of state, that they would be more likely that they would be more likely to think only in terms of these few cliches that the White Citizens Council has.
How many young Mississippians do you know? Of your roughly your age.
Not many. I would say we've spoken to 4, 5, 6 people. No, it would be more than that. Under a dozen. That's not knowing either, really. That's pretty much
what it. What kind of people were they? Social, economic, other background these 12 be?
Students of, for the most part, one salesman, can you think of?
But these young people all took the standard segregationist line, is that it?
No, on the whole, these were people who, reasonable. On the other hand, there was something that stopped. You came to a phrase. I remember a conversation about paternalism, for example, which we talked about a long time for about about Mississippians treating Negroes well, and a genuine love existed here. And we tried to get closer to define the term, to say, well, how can it be love if you never allow people to pass beyond a certain point, if you never allow them to grow any further. So that what the term meant to us, it did not mean to them, and we could really never get beyond this.
This question has many at the possibility of human relations, decent human relations. I've talked to people in this town, some Negroes in this town, who have said that the fact that over the centuries they have been bonds of personal understanding and personal affection between Negro and white individuals is a great asset in a Southern situation. Not a few Negroes will say that. Others will deny it hotly. It's always been a trap, always been a lie. Can you find anything said about this?
Well, I've talked to lots of Negroes. And as I see it, you see, this starts with a long thing, and I'll go through the whole resume.
Yeah,
we've had long conversations about negritude, about Negroness, about Negroes being in America but not of America somehow, and thereby Negroes, or the majority of Negroes, it is said, have escaped the evils of America. It's a very general opinion of this sort. From this general opinion, I react in this manner. I cannot say that because he's not been of America, he's escaped, simply because he hasn't really participated, he's not aware of, he can't be damaged or tainted by the practices of America, the culture, the mediocrity. As I see it, the fact that the Negro hasn't been involved in the dynamic aspects of American government means that he girds to himself the most shallow parts of our culture, the American culture in general. And in other words, that I think, my opinion is that the majority are suffering under a great delusion. As far as, now this goes to the personal affection that have existed between whites and the Southerners, white Negroes, whites and Negroes. I found that they mostly use it as one that sort of defrays that pushes the guilt. You see, they walk around in this atmosphere of secrecy that these
Negro does.
The Negro and the white, who has this...
Both.
Yes, who have this... Yeah, both of them. Certainly, the whites are, I think, under much more direct pressure from whatever the White Citizens Council than the Negroes. But the fear for the Negroes lives long after, naturally, the reason for that fear. What I'm saying is that the whites and the Negroes who do have this sort of bond use it mostly to show to each other how reasonable they are. Or they use it to, I've known them to use it indulgently as a sort of pat themselves on the back sort of thing, a very secret understanding of the real problems and the fact that a bond can exist between us too. For the Negro, I think there can be a genuine affection between two people, period. For the Negroes here who haven't risen further than a shoeshine boy or a maid or taxi cab driver, for them, I think it's part of the schism that you said Du Bois talks about is the assimilation or... For the Negroes who are on the upper level, the higher echelon here, who have developed bonds of relationships between whites, let's see, I think that you can't, either system, if Mississippi is a product of inexposure and ignorance, let's say, then neither parties can escape unharmed. Now, I don't, this means that both of them have to be somehow damaged mentally. Their patterns of thought cannot be normal. And I would start from there and say, not casually at all, that any relationship that they have together, it cannot be just positive. It can be positive, but it cannot be one that should, that it can be accepted on a normal positive. It can be positive, but it cannot be one that should, that it can be accepted on a normal basis. That they have to have, there has to be certain conversations and overconversations enmeshed in the relationship.
I was talking with a very brilliant young lady at Howard some time back. She's second in the law class there, and has been through the mill. She's been on the demonstrations and been in the jails. And she's a splendid orator, too. Very appealing one. But this was a private conversation. She said, was born on a farm in Virginia and raised there. I have optimism about the Southern situation, she says, because the Negroes and the whites in the South have a common history. There have been lots of common mutual recognitions, human recognitions over the centuries. But even when you find violence, you find it in human terms. The man knows what he's doing in the human sense. There's some inkling of it anyway. What frightens me is Harlem or Detroit or Chicago, where there's no common experience to fall back on. She says, I think here we have some ground for optimism, for working it out into a world of decent human relations. Does that make any sense to you? Now, you both are from another world. Does it make any sense to you?
I used to think that somehow the Southern situation would evolve a more pure black and white relationship than the Northern situation. That was before I lived here.
Where have you lived except Mississippi?
In Ohio, Cleveland.
I mean, where in the South have you lived?
Nowhere. Nowhere lived except Mississippi. I've been to Atlanta and visited there for 2 weeks.
But you think she's wrong now?
I think that she's opposing two things which don't necessarily relate. I think that the Northern situation can almost be approached on a level that would apply to the American situation, that there is unemployment and there needs to be fair housing provisions and there needs to be an integration of the schools for economic reasons. I think that the Northern situation is one that has a much more natural approach. There are ghettos, there are Negro ghettos, there are Puerto Rican ghettos, there are Polish ghettos, and the person who's governing should take this into account. I mean, we'll have to approach it from the fact that we're getting rid of our ghettos. I think that, in one sense, I think the situation is equally hopeless, because I don't find that, I think that the Southern white, is very ignorant of the Southern Negro. It's almost entirely, not only is much more afraid, at least in the North there are chances for the sea. The whole point is to think of a common background as a uniting force. And of course we think of it when it's all understood, such as in France, I suppose, if I were in France and I was a Frenchman, I walked into a room of Frenchmen with a whole lot of Americans, I would naturally gravitate to the table of Frenchmen. And they're uniting cultural ideas. To apply it to make it, in fact, you can't improvise. To make it, in fact, say that one will produce a much
that one is, has a much more positive effect on the South. I think that the Southern white is entirely ignorant of the Southern Negro. And I'll say it because the maids, the bonds of affections and the sympathy have been on distorted terms. And that wherever they've known a Negro, a Southern white has known a Negro, he's never known a real Southern Negro. Or he's never known that Negro. He's known a facade that he's had to, that the Southern Negro has had to put up in order to preserve himself. And the Southern white has never been out to come out in the open to really know that Negro. He had to put on a facade with the Negro himself. And I think that where it's raw violence, if there happens to be an outbreak in Harlem, where there's raw violence because they've seen each other, actually, I don't agree with the
young lady,
I think that it's a whole lot of, I think that's a product, it's a whole lot of sympathetic bull crap, to think that the Southern, that, you know, this can be approached on a sympathetic bond, some lean that unites the two simply because they've known I think that's a product of it, matter of fact. Gee,
you think it's easier in Cleveland?
Easier in Cleveland, I think that...
To have in the future a rational society, a humane society.
I think, yes, I think it's easier in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I think here, after we go through the relations bit, we have to go through the whole ignorance bit. I mean, these have to coincide. But I think I've not found such a deficit in mental and thought here than I've found in any place I've gone. And the institutions preserve it. I think that it's not a product of emotions. I mean, I approach it consciously, and I think that while in Cleveland and New York, they are clearing up the educational system, the revolution in math. There's a possibility of academic freedom there. There's propaganda in favor of thinking. Here, there's not, and they will resolve. Are pure, if we can talk in these terms, better white relationships because people will be able to think better there, not because of any sympathetic bond. People are not able to think here. That's right. I used to think that too. But I face here, you see, a Cleveland. I face here very similar to Cleveland. I grew up there.
Yes, you said Cleveland.
Yeah, well, here, that I'm not like a grown-up in the Cleveland that I grew up in. And as I see Cleveland going through certain evolutions, my mother called me and said, they're having riots here because the Negro kid doesn't get an education that the white kid gets. And my mother, to admit this, 10 years ago, she couldn't have. But I see, just like when I went to France, I saw of 1942 America in the sense of the planes and the advertising and the whole influx of American society. I think that it's not only, you know, it's a rational, it's an evolution of thought as well, possible.
Let me give another quote for the starting point. Well, I'll paraphrase it. I don't lay hand to it immediately. Oh, yes. This is by Gordon Hancock, another Negro social scientist, historian. The color question is a social problem, and as such, is no different, essentially, from any other social problem. And by reason of this fact, it responds to the same pressures of adjustment or maladjustment. Social problems, by their very nature, do not lend themselves to instantaneous and absolute solutions. Now, how do we square such a view with freedom now? Does freedom now mean instantaneous and absolute solutions? If not, how do we square them? See what I'm driving at?
Yeah.
I didn't put it very well, would you?
you want to say?
I really think not, but on the other hand, I fail to see how anyone could operate against these odds without having a very high ideal in mind.
Well, the ideal, yes, but let's press it a little bit. You mean freedom now is an emotional slogan which cannot, for the nature of the case, conform, be referred to the real social process. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Freedom now represents, and it cannot be made to, what happens is, it's certainly emotional, but what it represents is the question, why? It's the facing, a confrontation of the incomprehensibility of the system itself. And why, at the same time...
Say that again. That struck me as interesting. Can you say it again?
I guess. Certainly it's an emotional reaction. To make it, to put in these terms, to say that it cannot be made to conform with the regular due process of social change. What it is... It's the confrontation with the incomprehensibility of the system, or the incomprehensibility of prejudice and discrimination. And so in this sense, it is at the same time asking, why isn't it possible that social change can be instantaneous? I mean, it's a very naive question in a sense. Why isn't it possible that people are able to realize and that social change is able to come about because you've been proved a fallacy in thought, or because you can see exactly what's being done by discrimination in the caste system. So it seems to me that although reasonable people realize that change will be a gradual process, that freedom now is again an attempt, and can only be an attempt, especially in Mississippi, where we realize that jobs will not come immediately, you know, that unemployment will not be solved immediately.
Because they aren't here, you mean?
Because they aren't here, yes. It can only be an attempt to attract the national attention. It can only be an attempt to bring into the mainstream of society the injustices that one is suffering. Now, this is the only way that we're ever going to accomplish any change, I suppose, to make people aware of what exactly is going on.
As you mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to say it back so I'm sure I've got what you mean. And a little differently. Do you mean that the now actually is a definition of a direction of achievement rather than a statement of expectation of immediate solution?
No, it's both. At the same time, I'm saying that the emotional reaction is the expectation of immediate solution. And for leaders, I would suppose, the people who realize that freedom means in terms of sitting where you want to in the Coliseum, I mean, making sure that taxpayers' money is going for the benefit of the whole society, of sewers and street lamps, and of responsible government. For people who realize that this is what freedom is, it's a direction. I mean, they are leading the people. They're leading the people. For the people themselves, for me, and I would choose the emotive questioning. I would choose, even though this is not politic, this is not the way that this is. In other words, to say that, here's the thing. When people talk about gradual change, when people talk about understanding the system and reacting realistically within it, which I would suppose which would be in agreement with the due process of some social change. These people themselves are almost incomprehensible.
Excuse me a second. I don't think Hancock means by due process a necessarily retarding of process, but just the fact that time is always an element of social change.
Well, certainly.
If I could turn your question, perhaps, I would wonder if the leaders responsible for bringing about social change can ever be asked to understand due process.
Perhaps the leaders do, but know something else. It's not politic to study it that way.
No, I think then they cease to be leaders.
Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence and also said liberty is gained by inches. One's a dramatic revolutionary act. The other is a historical observation. They are the same man. See what I'm getting at?
All right. I would say then that perhaps the programs, you know, I can see the programs organized under the banner of Freedom Now as perhaps moving by inches. On the other hand, I think the impatience has to be established.
This is the same topic, but I want to approach it another way. Why wouldn't this revolution have occurred 30 years ago in the middle of the Depression? There was certainly provocation, there was suffering. There was the same, even more injustice by some standards, you see. There was more brutality then than now, I should think. Why wasn't the revolution then?
Partly due to, you see, it seems that in the 30s, there wasn't as much identification with the labor force, which was a revolution mainly of labor, protest.
Labor revolution, yes.
Didn't encompass the world that the revolution, that the Negro revolution encompassed. The labor forces did not encompass the moral, as a matter of fact, it was under a banner, it was under a more ideological banner, fluctuating between, in other words, I'm saying that the Negro Revolution, I think, encompasses more, touches more institutions, upon more institutions, and touches upon more, it has an added dimension that, which would tend to involve people in it, than the labor of the 30s.
But why didn't the Negro make himself felt then in something approximating the way he makes himself felt now?
All I can say is that there's an evolution of thought going on. There's an interesting essay by Esther Jackson, who writes about the Negro, which the Negro looked on viewed with modern day sensibility, which is she chooses the image of the absurd. She chooses three novels Richard writes, and
do you want to catch your phone?
Okay. Well, I want to say what I want to say. She goes to Ellison,
Ralph
Ellison. And it shows this as the evolution, let's say, of the Negro thought, of the Negro equilibrium, of Negro equanimity, and saying that the novel that Richard Wright wrote, viewed through the image of, well, the whole point is that I would tend to say that, well, first there are added things. I would can add the Africa. I'm going. Yeah, the Africa, the fact that Africa has certainly asserted itself, and before there used to be a non-identification with Africa, and now is an identification with the power there and the blackness. And this also is a step in an evolution of thought. And there's an accumulation of knowledge of ourselves here. I'm not sure whether I'm speaking of in the correct terms.
Increasing group identity.
Increasing group identity, and also knowledge of the past, knowledge of the fact that our history, the struggle of the history, started with the slave revolts, and that it's been going on, and I mean that people have been doing
if we were aware of the fact that Nat Turner, after Du Bois, said and thought in 1910 or whatever, 1910, exactly what we're thinking now, and was faced with the same problems.
That is there's a long evolutionary process involved, which this is an episode.
Pardon? Of which, yes.
Of which this is an episode.
Yes, that's, I would think of it in those terms.
I don't want to keep you away from that phone.
An evolution of thought and an evolution of awareness. I don't know about
that. Where would the Negro leadership have come from, the massive Negro leadership, have come from 30 years ago? Was it there?
And I suppose that, I haven't thought about this so much. I suppose that too, naturally, is a factor.
There are individuals that we can name, but now there are so many you couldn't begin to name them, who have that quality of leadership, who actually are functioning as leaders and organizers. Where would that come from 30 years ago?
Well, from the big cities.
If they were there, why didn't you get the action?
Let's see. There was a whole thing here. It seems that during this time, Negroes were just struggling to make it into the white society more than the Negroes in general did not have the spiritual opportunity to think of revolution, of change. And that they were, Harry Belafonte at that time was struggling to become a singer. Other people who had made it were struggling just simply to show that their own individual talents were recognized. And I think that this is part of it, that we've gone through certain stages.
Yes.
And if you ask where would the leaders have come from, Harry Belafonte today might be a leader.